Hello, my name is Hubert Loy, and my age is 84 years old, and I am old Rock Island locomotive fireman. I went to work for the Rock Island on the 5th of April, 1942, Trenton, Missouri, on the Missouri and Kansas Division. All of our engines then were steam, and the diesels came along in the year of 1944. My first pay trip on the Rock Island, I was called for number 912. It was a Des Moines run. It was with a 50-50 engine, and the fire engineer's name was John Riley. And we went to Des Moines, had a successful trip, and at 11:45 p.m. in the evening, I was called for a troop train with a 4,000-type locomotive. It was a train of soldiers headed for California, I suppose. Oh, talking about cold weather, I had some experience, and when it's deep cold weather and snow on the ground, we was coming into Allerton Iowa on the 50-50 engine. That's a big 5,000, a 484, and I had to take coal and water, and everything was covered with ice. And I got up on top of the tank, which is a story high. You had to be awful careful. You fall off, you'd kill yourself. And I said, after I took the coal and water, the brakeman come over from the depot at Allerton with the train orders and handed up the engineer. He passed them on to me. He told us it was 27 below zero. Another experience, we had a heavy tonnage train out of Kansas City. Well, they call it the Armadale Yards. And we called for the 990, that was it. And the engineer was Alan Barker. And we had to be pushed out of the yards. We had so much tonnage. So up some of the big hills, and we had to stop and take water at Elmira. And then we went on to Shoal, Polo, that's it, my goodness. Polo, and I had to take coal. And that was joint track with the Milwaukee Railroad. And I got up on the engine, I opened the chute, and here come the coal, and I couldn't shut it off. And the coal was running over the other track and in the cab, and the engineer got off of the seat and come up there, and he helped me, and we couldn't, and I emptied the whole coal chute. But he whistled out a flag when we stopped, and we protected the other main line. And when we got back, finally got to Trenton. Well, then we was called up and wanted to know what happened, and we told him just like I'm telling you now. My first trip running as a locomotive engineer was during the big flood in Kansas City, when the yards in Kansas City was a terrible mud hole, and I was the second train, I believe, to go down to Kansas City. And I was called out of Trenton with a 2710, and a fireman was Leonard Stotts. And when we reached the Missouri River Bridge, they held us, and I was instructed to call for signals. Four long blasts of the whistle, and the guy at the other end of the bridge gave me a stop sign. So I acknowledged it with a couple of toots of the whistle, and I turned the headlight off, and we sat there for quite a few hours. And it's a good thing I took water at every tank, because it's going to be a long time getting over the road here with the conditions like there were. So finally, he stopped out there and gave me a highball. I answered, put the headlight on the engine, put the reverse lever in forward motion, and I eased out. I had a 75-car train, not too heavy a tonnage, and we proceeded to cross. And at the other end of the bridge, there was a guy that got on the engine and said, take it mighty, mighty slow. It's in awful bad shape. So we went on, he got off, and we kept moving slow, and here all of a sudden the engine leaned clear down. It felt like it was going to turn over, but it was a soft spot, and that stink was terrible. The mud and the boxcars and the stuff was all oozed all over. It was the awfulest mess, and mud. And finally we got to where they put us on this main track in Armadale, and when they cut the engine off, the brakeman did, and I backed up, and then we went ahead, and I left the engine at the roundhouse. I want to add, too, when you've been on the side for a number of years on the left side of the engine as a fireman, and you're looking out there at 35 to 40 feet of boiler, when the engine makes a right turn, you can't see a signal, you can't see nothing, the engineer, and sometimes the brakeman's over there looking, but then when it makes the curve to left, you have to call a signal like yellow block, all red, so forth like that. Well, when approaching downhill in Birmingham, I was traveling awful fast. That 2017 was kind of jumping up fast. And you know, I had to walk over to the fireman's side and look for a landmark that I'd seen before where the engineers got a hold of them with the automatic brake valve. And I spotted this thing and I went right back and I drawed off about 12 pounds air. And when it quit exhausting, I got about 5 pounds more and held on to it. But I got a clear signal. And if it'd been yellow, I'd have took a little extra more precautions. But it was clear, and that's when we approached the bridge. And then we got a caution block. That's to expect to find the next one in a stop position of color red. And it was operated by CTC, Territory Automatic Train Control. And so that's where they held us there for a long time. Another experience, called out at Des Moines, Iowa, on a passenger train. It's a number 15. It's a real fast piece of railroad, the short line. 70, 75 mile an hour elevated curves, real fast, and them big engines. And them 4,000 could run, you couldn't believe it. Down through some of them hills, they do about 100 mile an hour, but they couldn't attain that speed only for a short time. And out across the flats and up another hill, but it was a fast moving railroad. And one time out of Des Moines, we got just out the edge of the town there, running very fast, and kabang, the engine shook, and the tire on the left number 3 driver broke, and a piece of it come up and hit the jacket, boiler jacket, and scratched it all. Well, it made a cut in it, but we got stopped, and they had to send a section crew out there with men and the tools and put another tire on it. The tire is a big rim that goes around. It has a flange on the wheel. So that was that. I was called at Trenton to Deadhead. Of course, I took my car and I drove St. Joe about 80 miles. And I had to run the one-man switch engine for 2 days, or 3 days it was. And it was this little funny-looking diesel. And I was a young man and at that time, and we had a lot of switching to do. And, well, we just switched boxcars right and left down there at St. Joe. And finally, they got a hold of me, and I went back to Trenton to resume my railroading. When I first started out railroading, the business on the railroads then during the war years was tremendous. I don't think they've ever had anything like that since. Trains from California with fruit and PFE, Pacific Fruit Express cars, that's called, and it'd be maybe a whole trains of that with a pretty yellow boxcars, refrigerator cars, I'll get it pretty soon. And packed with ice and vegetables and stuff like that. Then we had wheat trains. Then we had oil trains, tankers that during the war. And these oil trains would be maybe 90 cars of tankers loaded with oil. And then coming back, we'd have as many as 100, 110 cars of empty oil tanks. And all this rush, and then the passenger traffic was tremendous. They had passenger trains, sections of the Golden State. They had 22 cars on the Golden State. And it was pretty hard to make their time, running time. They shortened the schedule, and you had to do that much faster to make the running time to meet the schedules and so forth like that. So business was great, and trains be in the passenger tracks, inferior trains coming west, and as soon as the good fast trains and the important trains went by, they let you out, and away you went as far as you could, and here comes some more. And dropping back to Armadale, Kansas, I've been on the engine and quite a few hours, and me and the engineer, and as soon as we got off the engine and walked around the house, the clerk said, "Hey, wait a minute, you guys are called right now." I said, good gosh. And the engineer said, I don't care. I'm going over and we're going to have some breakfast. He said, okay, the engine's waiting. You're going right back to Trenton. And that's the way it was. And in the roundhouse, we walked through there. That was a big, huge, tremendous place. And they had these gigantic big iron lathes that lift a pair of wheels off that engine up there, and they turned the wheels, and they done all kinds of mechanical work. They took the jackets off the boiler, and you could see it was, maybe 5-6 inches thick of what's this insulation they use nowadays for electric irons and everything. They have so much trouble with it. Say
asbestos,
that's it, asbestos. Tubs of asbestos, and they mix that up, and they put that on there. And they done all kinds of heavy work. Take an engine completely apart and put it together, and it was quite an interesting thing to see. And I liked big machinery, and it was interesting, and these big engines rode like a Cadillac, nice and smooth, and the passenger engines, it was pretty good size too, and they did. So that was fine days of railroading. The people were much different. It was a nice class of men. They tended their business. They done the job right. And, we just didn't have no trouble. And now you look and see what they are, rear end, head on collisions, and they're off the track and on the track and something else, isn't it? Bye.
You talked earlier about you were based in Trenton, and you went four different directions out of Trenton. You want to talk about those?
Okay. This is Hubert Law again, and on the Missouri and Kansas Division. Trenton was a subdivision, and all trains east or westbound had to stop there and be serviced. Coal, water, sand, the mechanics all done that. And then they had the fire. They shook the grates down. They called it cleaning the fire. And we were based, that's base place. The main base was Trenton, Missouri. So then we worked four ways out of there. We went to St. Joe, Missouri, about 80 mile. And that was a hand-fired engine, a small 280 wheel arrangement. And then that was a little passenger train sometimes went down there with the same type of engine. And it had one passenger coach and maybe one or two boxcars. It's called a mixed train. I forget the name of the run. And it went down to St. Joe and stayed there, probably 20 minutes. Then it went on down to Kansas. What's the name of that Kansas?
Atchison,
Kansas. Never think of it. And then they turned the engine around on a push type turntable, and we come back to St. Joe and back up to Trenton. Now that's St. Joe. Now we had a main line. It went to Kansas City, and the passenger trains went on to the Union stations, and in Kansas City there we crossed the Missouri River, of course, and that was Armadale. Rockhounds had a big yard there, and they could ice a whole train at once. They built an ice plant down there. They could ice automatically 90 cars of ice when they hauled the PFEs with fruit and stuff like that. And then we worked to Des Moines, branching off at Allerton. And then the other one, we went straight to Eldon, and that continued on up to the Illinois Division into Chicago. But each division was so many miles, and we had to stop and service the engines they did. And that was our, as far as we went, change crews. And I think Eldon Highway was 112 miles, 114, I believe. And Des Moines was 115 mile division. Kansas City was right at 100 miles, and St. Joe the Hanford was 86. And the big 5,000s, they had to take coal and water there. The 4,000 passenger engines, they were all modernized with big tanks and roller bearings and automatic lubrication to the cylinders and all this. You didn't have to use them long spouted oil cans no more. And they could go from one division to the next before they had to take any coal or water. Mighty fast trains, and the engines like that, they rode pretty nice, like a nice automobile.
You talked earlier about the cinders that are generated in the firebox and having to clean them out.
Yep.
Could you describe that again?
When the engines come in either the east or the west there and for service, they stopped on the main line, and the crews, the fire knockers, they call them, they got up there with a big long hoe and a rake-like, and they shook the grates down and shook the fire down, you know, a lot of it. It had lots of cinders, and you can imagine, put in all that, about 20-some ton of coal goes through them things, and they hold 20,000 gallons of water is getting down low. They use that much, and sometimes with some occasions they had to take it before they even got to Trenton. So when the train's pulled out, then there's two or three men down there with wheelbars, and they got out in this pit where the engine straddled that pit and on the main line, and then they would get a shovel. It was about waist deep, and they'd shovel these cinders out in these wheelbars, and they wheeled them up a plank, and they dumped them into a coal car, an open car. You probably know what that is. Gravel, sand, they haul in it. And it was a lot of hard work. I tried it once, it was pretty darn heavy. And boy, I don't know how they stayed with it, but they'd done it for a number of years.
In the freight engineers at Trenton, did you have more than one freight pool, an east end pool, a west end pool? How
freight,
did that work?
Well, on the we worked as according to first in, first out. When you come in from Kansas City, an engineer fireman would sign the register. So the next guy would sign it. And when they called the crew, you're first out. The next man would take whatever they had to call them. And we had a pool. And it wasn't very many before the war started. Your business wasn't doing much, and you laid around. But when the war started, it ended up, I think there was 20 crew freight pools in the West End and about 15 or 16 in the East End, because we got more trains from the West going towards Des Moines. But that was more crews than I've ever seen it in many, many years. Trenton Roundhouse was a small place, and they couldn't do only just minor repairs. When the major things had to take place, they run them down to Kansas City, run them light. I also called out at Trenton, and it said, well, he's called for a 5,000. I don't remember just exact the engine, but there was two, we double heading. And I got down there, and we was running two engines with a caboose. With all that horsepower, it's about 8,000 horsepower, or a little better, and with a caboose. And that was the funniest looking thing. Well, we didn't have to have a full head of steam. And the guy in the second engine, he didn't have to much, and he just kept him alive. And the reason they done that, they were trains arriving from the west, coming into Kansas City, and they didn't have no horsepower down there for them, not to handle them. So they double-headed two engines and the caboose, and the train crews rode in the caboose down there. And so they had the power then to bring the trains eastward. And they done that a lot of times. Also, when you're a fireman, they called you sometimes to, messenger. Yeah, they called you to be a messenger of dead engines. And what would happen when the engine come out of the factory from an overhaul, well, then they'd put them on the train, or maybe it's going to be overhauled. So when you went to messenger an engine, it was usually coupled behind the engine about five or six boxcars length, and you had some oil and some fusees. If something got to smoking, you could put one of these out the window, and engineer would stop, and you got paid for that just as much if you was working up there on the head end of firing a live engine. It's called a dead engine. And when they come out of the factory, and are either going, they had the main rods and disconnected, because if they didn't do that, the wheels turning would flatten the rails, break the rails. That's what they do, break them. And because they're out of counterbalance then, and they would have to disconnect them. So that was pretty easy, getting like a free ride, enjoying it, and providing nothing happened.
the messengers, they were only firemen, not
yeah, they. The messenger were only firemen. And the hostling job at Trenton was protected by the firemen on the extra board. And the hostler job, you'd be called, and you would be down at the roundhouse, and you would assist some of the guys over there washing down the cinders with a hose, and fill an inside lubricator, which they done away with them shortly. And 5,000s used to have a different kind of they had water pumps, and they were I forget what the name of them was. Twirl around like that. I forget what the name of that damn water pump was. But anyway, they took them off, and they put on injectors, Sellers injectors, and that worked pretty successful. And the 4,000s had a water pump on them. It was a different kind of thing. And when they first come out, they had, we called them one lunger, because they only had one air pump. And when you set the air on, it'd take forever for being effective, it seemed like. Now they equipped them with double big cross compound air pumps, and they were worked very successful.
How often did you see operating officials, train master, road foreman, assistant superintendent, those guys come around very often?
Not very often. We had a traveling engineer, they called him, that he would come, and he would get on the engine, and he would talk to you a little bit, but most generally he just wanted to see what you was doing, how you done it. Sometimes, you know, you operate an engine, working her down pretty hard, and you're wasting coal and water, and he'd record these things. And I come out of Des Moines with an engineer, and on the short line there to Allerton, he'd hurry like heck, a freight train. And then when he got to Allerton, from then on into going to Trenton, which is a long ways, he'd work the engine about a half throttle. It seemed like he didn't want to do nothing. And at that time, when we stopped there and got coal and water, there was a road fireman got on the engine. And it was strange. I forget, Billy something was this engineer's name. And this guy, road fireman, he went over there and just got a hold of that throttle and pulled it right up to the ceiling. And he didn't say a damn word, and I thought, uh-oh. Yeah.
Was all the territory between Kansas City and Eldon, and then from Allerton to Des Moines, was this all CTC, or was some of it ABS?
No, it was, when I started, it was CTC only to Kansas City.
From Trenton?
From Trenton.
Uh-huh.
Des Moines and Eldon were all time card and train order operated, and automatic signal, like these semaphore signals.
Okay. So, on the east end, the guy had to learn pretty quick timetable and train orders and how to make it work.
Well, it's
and
usually,
how to stay out of trouble.
Yeah, it's a long time for a guy to learn the road, you know. You go over it quite a bit, but they could tell you, be asleep and tell you where they're at, I think. You just had to check the train orders, and because they date them wrong, and you accept them, they get you for that.
Yeah.
You got the train orders. You had to have a clearance that goes with it. It had to be addressed to the conductor and engineer. The date and all that had to be on there. And you looked at them. He looked at them, read them. He passed it on to him or the brakeman, whichever one of us looked at. And if it was a meat order somewhere, it looked like he wasn't going to acknowledge or something, hell, you do it yourself. It's your responsibility. All men on the crew were equal responsible for whatever happened.
Yeah. Well, that's not a bad way. Everybody's an employee, and everybody's a party to what's going on.
Yeah.
You've got a responsibility to look at it.
Just like Amtrak was coming along there on an interlocking plant, I guess it was. There's a crossing, they're going this way, and here come the dead engines, or the three units, no train behind them, just the three units, just like you run the light engine. They come up there and stop. Then the red signal had to be, and he just walked right into the Amtrak. I think it killed a couple of people, done a lot of damage, of course.
Yeah, that was back east. Now,
why didn't somebody else on there go and slam the brake on them? Hell with him.
Yeah.
I would have.
Well, I think there had to be two guys on there.
Well, yeah, them days, I suppose.
Neither one of them stopped.
Now they run some trains, I guess, without no damn... Nobody on there on the conductor. What I can't understand, what happens when you're operating a train connection like we are with the Milwaukee, and they do on the East End there somewhere in Illinois or wherever, and the train breaks in two. Well, back there on the Milwaukee, the train breaks in two. If you got a diesel, running the diesel, the fireman, the brakeman's got out, they can walk back and see what's happened. Damn, please. Crabs. And anyway, he's got to walk back here. So the fireman's got to get his lantern at night. The red lantern ought to be lit when you get on the engine. That's one thing, you light the lights and check the tank, see you got a full tank of water. All this. Then if you break in two, bang goes there. You don't know, it's dark. You know what the hell back there, 40, 50 cars.
Yes.
The conductor, his brakeman, the rear brakeman, comes like this, looking for what's happened. Now, it could be they jump the track and this main line on the next to you there is all loaded with boxcars. All right? Nobody protect. Here comes a Milwaukee coming down here busting like hell. And he goes through there and turns over. So what in the hell did they do now? There's a conductor and an engineer there on these trains.
There's physically less protection.
I don't know what the heck they do.
I don't know.
Well, the fireman has to take his, I take some torpedoes and red fusees, and I went way down there, got the time, engineer call you back to the west. Put that torpedoes down, one rail length apart, big long distance, and when they explode, boom, boom, real loud, you maybe heard them.
I have.
Yeah. And that's right away, you grab a hold of that air and get to bring this train down to a speed and prepare to something, what, you know what the hell is. You find him down with a QZ.
Now, I can't remember, and of course, you were on the railroad a long time before I was. Did you carry the fireman and or the head brakeman have a flagging kit on the engine?
It's on there. You see it. It's on there.
Okay. And the roundhouse crew keeps it supplied so that it's ready for use all the
right
time.
Right in them places where you put your toilet. Where the coal chute comes down like this, right in this side of the thing there, is a big place. Where you got a lever you lift up to reverse the stoker, something gets in it and try to break it loose. You put a closed box there, and they always put fuses, a lot of them, and torpedoes. Either one down on the other side, the engineer side on the tank there in there, is the same thing.
Uh-huh.
One or the other got it. See, don't leave town, don't leave the roundhouse without this stuff.
Yeah.
Because you're responsible.
Yeah, that's part of the job.
You're doomed. Scoop, jump off the hole.
When you hired on as a fireman, by that time, all of the crafts were unionized, were they not?
Yes, well, I belonged to, I got a brotherhood of locomotive firemen engineers.
Okay. And when you were promoted, did you remain with the BLF&E or did you join the BLE?
No. There's a lot of engineers there with some real old, been in the service for God knows how long, and they never switched. Some did.
Uh-huh.
But he said, I went up through the ranks of the firemen. He said, I just paid my dues, and that was it.
Yeah.
Same thing, or you maybe just an engineer. I got a choice to. I never wore that, but I had that made after I quit railroad just for the hell of it. But I had my lunch bench on it.
Yeah.
Even some of the factory trains had pushers. And they had them down the gorge, just up working the hell out of them, pushing these trains up. Passengers and freights.
Uh-huh.
Mostly the freights or the passengers can handle it all, but sometimes they had to have a pusher. And when we got off at Eldon, we had to walk that mile when the snow's that deep, or deeper than ice, and we had to cross the bridge. The trains coming down, they used to come down pretty damn fast.
You're out there on the bridge with them.
Dark, and you know, it had room about like this, but in the wind blowing up that bridge, and you know, I kind of hugged to the side. It had a rail there built up like a fence while there, this old wooden bridge, snow and ice, and I was always afraid that maybe there's a chunk of wire hanging out there or something, even the log that, you know, no engineers that broke, Clyde Ellis, and I can't think of them names right off the bat. I'm going to think of them pretty soon. But anyway, he said, I sure wish I had legs like yours. And then I just
long legs?
Yeah, long legs. He says, my legs hurt me so bad. Gosh. But that was a long walk.
This walk that you took, this was because you pulled up in the vicinity of the depot or the yard, and you changed crews there.
The yard was clear across the river. Not the yard, but the roundhouse.
And that's where
the depot.
And that's where you tied up. The engineman tied up at the roundhouse.
Yeah.
Okay. That's why you had to walk across the bridge.
Right. But that was sure inconvenient. In the wintertime, sometimes some people there in Elvin would have to drive clear around to where they could cross the river bridge someplace from the cars and take us over in the taxi.
Well, it's kind of nice to have a helping hand occasionally.
And one of them winter nights, oh God knows how cold it was, snowed deep. And we got in there, we walked over the bridge, and the rooms the firemen and engineers had was over the slough. Can you imagine what the hell that is? All the noise,
yep.
and the music going on. And we went up there, and they're supposed to keep the stove. They said, big old stove, I'm trying to keep it hot, and heated these rooms up. Was no fire. Cold, my gosh. And I took my shoes off, I left my overalls on, my clothes, and I got in bed and with my damn clothes on, keep freezing. Two restaurants in the town, one was Whitey's restaurant, and the call boy, but the one that called you, she was a woman. What the hell's her name? You think right off the she called over there. She came up here and shook you and woke you up. Yeah, you're called from so-and-so at a certain time. She worked for the railroad, I guess, for 40, 50 years. I read that in one of them things you got from the Rock Island technology thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, boy, she put in a lot of service. Hazel was her friend's name.
Hazel?
Yeah. I like the thrill of it. It was a thrill of it.
I.
And you know, some of the engineers had an extra red handkerchief tied around their neck to keep the coal dust out. They had their fancy clothes. We've got a picture there when I did tie them up.
Uh-huh.
That's for keeping it. You get over the coal and everything, you can get down your shoes.
Yeah.
But it was kind of an old tradition. One engineer said, what do you want to wear that for one evening? I said, oh, I don't. He said, just take it off. So I did. I wore my old jacket.
Everybody has individuals you figured out for yourself.
And,
some of it's style and some of it has some use.
And nowadays, it's awful what they have. The main overhauls was Lee and Oshkosh.
Yeah.
I don't think you can buy them now. Anything made in China wouldn't come near.
No. I don't know. It seemed like a few years ago I saw an advertisement. In fact, it might have been for kids' clothing. Was Oshkosh Bagosh. So I guess they still do something, but not like they did.
In fact, I haven't seen overalls. I don't. It must have been women overalls. It looked like what we had. And one of the guys, young students, he had on. I think I told you. A watch. Had a gold chain on it. My dad says, when you get on these engine and everything, don't wear no nice chain. That's for dress. Take a shoestring, you know, tie it in, and
uh-huh.
You loop it over, loop it through, and there's a watch pocket on your overhauls, put it in there. And this guy had one of these hose, and he's pushing something down around the firebox there, and it caught on this hook, and then when he's watching the firebox, are you going to dive in after it?
I don't think so.
He lost it. He probably paid $100, maybe more.
Think the man learned a lesson that day?
I think so. And you had to have a watch rating every 15 days. You go to the jewelry store, it didn't cost you nothing, but they kept a record, and if you didn't do it, they'd find out why.
And this was simply to take it in to an approved jeweler and let him check to be sure it was operating right?
Yeah, they set it by a standard clock. Wall, and everybody had to do that was in train or engine service, not the section man or I don't know what they did and so forth like that. But you had to do that. My dad says, be sure, don't forget to get a watch radio. And I have a card there too in that book I showed you. Watch radio. You signed a form and they signed it and they checked it and they put down how many seconds, slow or fast, or something like that. And you're supposed to, them days, you wind the watch the best time every day at the same time if you could think of it. Remember? Now you put a watch on, you don't even need nothing for, go along for years. You don't do
it.
Wrist watches now, I guess they use them on trains. Wonder if I got one. I got a Seiko that says a railroad approved. Have you seen them?
I haven't. But somebody was telling me, some other Santa Fe or some guy said that they don't even have time checks anymore. The precise timekeeping basically is no longer an issue on the railroad. Yeah.
They don't, they don't have a lot of things they used to have either. And this record speaks for itself. Look at the collisions. The hell, I'd be firing a lot of people if I was operating the railroad. Some of this is no excuse. They don't have, they don't have the rule 99. That was the most important rule in the book. That's protecting against
crazy. There's nobody back there anymore.
And I'd like to ask somebody, I don't know myself, why do they have a thing on the back end of the train that gives the pressure? The engineer's got this right in front of him there on the gauges. Main reservoir, brake pipe pressure, how the lines synchronize. What the hell do they have it back there for? And now, we used to call them the car toads. He'd walk along and expect the train when it come in from either Des Moines or Eldon or so forth. He'd walk along, check, of course, there wasn't ball bearings. There's an old brass bushing in there, you know, back the waste and the oil. And when he got to the rear of the train, he'd counter, give a sign like this. That means set him up. The brakeman to holler up, he's down on the ground getting that signal from the rear brake. Set him up, the engineer make a reduction, the brakes. Then they go like this, slow. That means release the brake. And he'd blow two blasts of the whistle. In a few seconds, put her down the corner, take off. You don't just pull like this, you tear everything. You ease them up there a little bit. So we're moving ahead. Remember, she goes to take it off, come right on out, brother.
Yeah. My understanding that basically that rear end device on the knuckle of the last car actually takes the place of the conductor or brakeman who's got an air gauge on the caboose.
Yeah.
This thing is a pressure measuring device with a transmitter and a receiver on the locomotive that tells the engineer what his pressure is at the tail end of the last car.
Okay, suppose a brake beam comes down. They very seldom have hot boxes now, I don't think, like they used to have.
Not near as much, but they do.
Okay.
When I was on the railroad 30 years ago, a number of occasions on my territory burned off journals, roller bearings.
Suppose they're going along just fine and bang goes there. Well, no, we want just back up a little. Boat's going right along, and there's sparks and fire flying back there, and it's snow. The conductor, he looks back there. Now, what the hell's that guy what's that box going to do for you? Engineer can't see it. He's back 75, 80 cars back.
Right.
So what? The conductor, he could stick out a fusee on that thing, and the engineer don't acknowledge it. Get that conductor's valve right there, that brake valve. Open it slowly, he's bringing him right down. And then the engineer will look back to see if he's got pulling air on him.
I can only guess that the railroads made a judgment. They think that they're going to have some problems because there's nobody on the back end of the train. But they think they're going to save enough money by not employing these people that they can offset the problems that result when nobody's back there. I presume that's their thinking.
To me, they're greedy, I think, too.
Well,
they don't have to have a caboose, do they?
Well,
and a crew.
That's part of it. And part of modern society, How can we get rid of labor?
Yeah, look at the damned airplanes are falling out of the sky. Some of them sitting still, the engine falls off. That's here a long time ago. We told it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
They falsify records.
Yeah.
So does the railroad.
Yeah.
Dead. But you know, went along many, many years until they had that rear end collision. I had that guy run into my dad's freight train. My dad was on his the freight train, the Imperial.
You want to tell that story that you got from your dad?
Did I tell it?
Can you tell the story?
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
Is it on now?
It's on.
My dad was called for an X-ray west. He was at Eldon Highway. And if I had the picture, I could tell the diesels, maybe his numbers on it. But it's in here someplace. Anyway, he had a four-unit diesel. I mean, it might have been a four-unit diesel then. And he had 100 boxcars and the caboose. And he left a long time ahead of the passenger train. And when the passenger train left Eldon, it was 46 or 47, I forget, I'd have to look it up there, make it positive. Anyway, coming into Allerton, why, everything worked just fine. They had a diesel, didn't have to stop for no fuel. It slowed down where they could pick up orders, medium speed. And on down there below Clio, on level track, flat country, and they're going right along just fine. Well, the conductor seen something sparks a-flying. He thought it was a brake beam dragging or something.
This is on your dad's freight train.
My dad was the engineer on the freight train. So the conductor began to pull air, so Dad set the automatic, and he stopped. My dad whistled out a flag. That's one long and three short whistles. That means the conductor and the rear brakeman get off and protect the train or investigate what's going on. And here come the Imperial passenger train. At that time, it's running at the speed of 50 miles an hour. And my dad looked back and he said, "My gosh," he could see this passenger train had an oscillating headlight that flickered, made a figure eight across the tracks right away. You could see it. He said, "My God, they're going to hit us." And my dad said, when they collided, it near knocked him down in the cab of 100 cars away. And they run through, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 cars. A box cars, the caboose was just like cream. Went through that many, and they turned over. And eventually, they caught on fire, a couple of units. Fire, and they had to put that out. And it was early in the morning. It was dark when it happened. And my dad, when he got home, he come and told me what happened. And I got in my automobile, and I drove to Allard. Or drove up there where it happened, Lineville, Clio. And it was the damnedest mess you ever seen. Cold, there was a stiff breeze blowing, and about looked like a couple of inches of snow was on the ground, real cold. So the cab of that diesel, the passenger train that hit the freight train, it looked like nobody could survive. And I showed you the picture, and all they did was kind of scratched up and cut up a little bit. Nothing serious, and that was something else. And Jake Cordes was the engineer, and Bill Crispin was the fireman on that. And they evidently proved that they didn't acknowledge the signal indications. They passed this caution block, and they didn't touch the air. And he claimed that the air froze up. That was a big joke. They took the air pipes off. They took the automatic brake valve. They tested it, and. Well, I couldn't find no moisture at all in anything would do that. And they said, in the wee hours like that, and a cold winter night, and a nice warm diesel cab, they both drifted off to sleep.
Yeah.
And later on, they fired the engineer for good. He never got back to work. And Bill Crispin, he went on, and he was out of service for quite a while. And later on, he was back, he got it. Was running, and he was up to Des Moines. I don't know, my good friend Dale Davison, he was a nice, fine young man. He followed me in seniority, and he wrote and told me that Chrisman got into some kind of trouble up there on the short line. Maybe he's on the work train. They give you a certain time to work, and you got to call the flag or get on the siding. Well, he didn't do, I don't know what it was, and he didn't know, but he said they fired him then, and that was the end of his railroad. In them days, if they caught you drinking or doing something on the company property, you were gone. They didn't tolerate it. And you couldn't go around there with a big beard on and hair down your shoulders and do like they do today. They done it, thought it was strict. The Rock Island was judged by the appearance of its people and how you treated people and things like that. And I've been on Amtrak, and they had the conductor on there and the brakeman, and they had somebody that was supposed to be in charge. I forget what they called him, and it was, to me, it was a hell of a mess. I didn't like it.